Good afternoon and welcome to Aware. Hi, this is Lisa Garr. And have you ever really listened to or experienced the words of women? The essential women's wisdom through the ages is what we're talking about today. Mary Ford Grabowski is my guest, and she has compiled a book of splendid writings by more than 170 women called Sacred Voices, women including the Queen of Ancient Egypt and the author of the best-selling book, Women Who Run with the Wolves, Clarissa Pecola Estes. So just incredible understandings and perspectives and viewpoints all brought together through this compilation, which is a really wonderful read because you can pick it up in whatever state you're in. It's not a cover-to-cover read. You can really pick it up and take a look at, open it up and see what it has for you for that day, or read it cover to cover. It's a really, really nice book. And my guest, Mary Ford Grabowski, is on the line. Hi. Thanks
for
joining me.
Hi, Lisa. How are you?
Oh, good, good. You really have a unique understanding and respect for women's mystics. Women mystics.
I do now. It wasn't always that way.
Yeah, I understand that. How did you put all this together? What inspired you to put a collection of women's works together?
You know, I love to say that it really started when I was 17 years old, my first year in college, when I had this amazing teacher for my French lit class. And she was actually a brilliant, wildly enthusiastic, brilliant nun who also happened to be my house mother. And she, as we were chatting one night, she mentioned that every time she came across something really beautiful, some quote in literature or some words that really inspired her, she'd copy them down, these little slips of white paper, and she'd paste them inside her closet so that every morning she'd get up and she'd start her day with inspiration. So as an impressionable 17-year-old, I immediately picked up the habit and started posting sacred Band-Aids in my closet with all kinds of beautiful messages.
Sacred Band-Aids, what a cute term.
And thank you. Oh. And I, you know, to this day, I've never stopped. And so when I left college and I had my first apartment, I suppose my knees were getting larger, and I had all my closets and all my closet doors papered with these, well, by now we were on state-of-the-art yellow post-its.
Uh-huh.
And I could get up in the morning and on Monday morning and throw open the clothes, and there was, you know, Beethoven saying, "Oh, raise me from these heavy depths."
Mm-hmm.
Or some really beautiful mystical prayer, like one of my favorites was Ibn al-Arabi, who would say, "Listen, beloved, I am the reality of the world."
Oh, wow. You really have some things that make you stop and think, and it's just amazing that people are writing these words. I mean, coming across it on paper with words that just stop you in your tracks and encompass so much thought.
I went on because I've always been a big reader and have learned a lot of languages. And I actually was taking down in seven different languages. And by the time I was married and a mother and had a full-time career, I found myself in rather desperate need of a lot of inspiration. I had every single wall of every single closet papered in these, of course, by now, yellow, blue, orange, red, and as well as yellow post-its. And it was really a magnificent experience. But something strange happened, and not until this past 1995. Matthew Fox was the author of Original Blessing, had been a good friend of mine since 1983. If we get to it, I'll tell you about that later.
Yeah,
and he asked me to come here. He wanted to open a university. We talked about it for many years, and he asked me if I'd come here and be his vice president and academic dean. And so that took a lot of soul searching.
Huh.
And eventually, my husband found a job out here too. So here we came from the East Coast out here. And while I was packing for that trip, 1995, of course, I was unpeeling all my little sacred messages to put in this big box that I always carried with me when I moved. And for the first time in my life, this is just unbelievable. For the first time in my life, I discovered almost all my quotes from men. And I tell you, that discovery hit me in the stomach.
All the quotes were from male authors.
Male mystics,
poets.
Male contemplatives, male wise men, male artists, composers. It was amazing.
Why do you think that is? Is it just what you were studying at the time? I mean, that's a little uncanny, isn't it?
It is. It's very strange. It's mm-hmm. as late as 1995, you know, when we'd been through such a women's liberation movement.
Right, right.
And I, of course, I started looking at that very carefully, and because that meant I was not hearing the wisdom of half my own sex.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not hearing the wisdom of the women in my own mother line, my mother and grandmother and daughters. So,
was that true in your life that you were, that you, how was your relationship, if you don't mind my asking? Or
I don't mind at all.
Listening to your mother.
It was extremely good. With all my, we had a very extended family back in Massachusetts, and my relationship was extremely wonderful with all these women. And I very much appreciated my mother's intelligence. She was an opera singer who sang in four languages, and I think passed on to me my love of languages. But clearly, I did not have ultimate respect for the feminine. Clearly, culture had taught me the feminine is inferior, and that's all there is to that. And of course, I was dodging my own inferiority complex.
I mean, it's a lot of what culture does teach us, and there's not, I mean, up until recently, been a lot of respect for the feminine, and there's this kind of strange gap that women fall into where we either are running a lot of male energy in order to compete in a world of executives and owners of companies that are jobs that are otherwise defined by men. Women are in these positions now. And they're running so much male energy to stay up in these positions that quite often their own health gets sacrificed, or their feminine energy gets sacrificed. And there's not a place for it still in the workplace to be very feminine and to also be a hard head negotiator. You know,
right.
There's not a lot there. But also from what you're talking about of getting in touch with the feminine, of just being a woman. I mean, forget even being in the workplace. But being in this earth and having to make a living and raising children and being a little bit of survival about the job, and it all comes into play. And then we look at these images that society is giving us of women that are usually about shopping and being beautiful and staying at home and so forth. You don't really see a lot of practicality out there.
Would you believe the very first presentation I gave of this book in the Barnes & Noble? I love to interact with the people I'm presenting to, and so I asked them, I said, do you know what the very first piece of literature written on this planet was? And nobody knew, and I said, it's by a woman, and Edwana, and I said, well, what do you think it was? I mean, it seems pretty obvious, it's probably a praise of the goddess. I mean, that's what we wrote, that's the earliest literature. And a man said, it was probably a shopping list.
A man said this?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it was hilarious, and he's a good friend, so I accepted it in good spirit.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But it just, at the same time, the little joke meant, you know, really spoke to the stereotype.
A woman's place isn't the kitchen type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Right, right, right. And we shop, you know, we're compulsive shoppers. And so, so still the world does not know much about the fact that we have a sacred history, and which is what I've learned in the research I've done for this book, that we have a beautiful, in every century, every culture, every part of the planet, every society you can think of, there has been women who have gotten out there and have made their voices heard and left us sacred writings. And it's a treasure. It is just such a treasure, because if we could grasp that we have a sacred history and we are part of it, and that our own voices are part of the voice of the goddess, I mean, think of what that would do for our self-esteem and for our sense of inferiority in society.
It's very empowering and very inspiring.
Yeah.
But it also, I must say, is not anything against men. I mean, the fact that the rise of the feminine, the divine feminine, is being spoken about and written about so much, it has nothing to do with being anti-male. And I know that you don't say that anywhere near your book, and I just wanted to point that out to our listeners, to all of our male listeners. I'm sure you have something to say about
it. It has nothing to do with, I'm sorry, I couldn't hear what you said.
Oh, anti-male.
Uh-huh.
It has nothing to do with being against men. The
no,
rise, the
I don't
rise
think I have a single writing out of the 350 here that was critical of men.
That's what I said, yeah.
Yeah, it's love of men, appreciation of men.
Yes, and equality and appreciation of women and men, and balance between the two. And what is it that we do and we can learn from these very wise women in our past that have written these, and there are still actually in our present, and written these wonderful, wonderful quotes and stories that you have in this book, Voices of History, is one of the chapters I'm looking at. It's called Sacred Voices, Essential Women's Wisdom Through the Ages. What is it that we can learn from this?
Lisa, I'm having trouble hearing you.
You are?
Yeah.
You can't hear me?
I'm hearing some banging in the background.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if there's some feedback. It's just me in the studio here.
Hmm.
We'll go a little bit further here and tell me if you still hear the sound. But what is it that that we can learn, that we stand to learn from all of these writings, from women's wisdom through the ages? What is it that we stand to learn?
Just about everything.
Yeah.
That's a hard place to begin. There's a beautiful, beautiful quote from the Hebrew Scriptures, and it's also in the Kabbalah, and it says, if I can recall it correctly, in every generation, wisdom passes into holy souls and is a source of prophetic inspiration. And that's extremely important to me. Now, how does wisdom enter holy souls? It enters, obviously, through our spiritual practices, through silence, prayer, meditation, analyzing our dreams, all our dreams of the feminine, our mothers and daughters, and communities, and values and emotions. If we pay a lot of attention, we'll become conscious of that wisdom inside ourselves, and that changes the way we look at things. For instance, if something really hard comes along, this is one thing I have learned to do, and I can't understand it. I always find myself praying this little passage from. From the Hebrew Scriptures, it's, then thought I to understand this, but I could not until I went into the temple of God. Meaning, this makes no sense. I don't want this. I'm trapped. Why is this happening to me? But if we work on it in prayer and meditation, we'll find out. And that, to me, is wisdom, when we go deep like that.
That also speaks to me of allowing the universe to take over sometimes and to trust the universe.
Exactly.
It says a wonderful, I mean, it's the same thing that we're saying, but interesting. Really good stuff. You have been so wonderful to choose some of your favorite readings, some of the themes in the book, and we are going to be reading some of these on the air today and talking about them, and they're really moving. I mean, really moving stories and quotes and women's voices from the past and also from the future. I mean, from the future, from the present, from where we are now. And do you want to share some of these with us?
I would love to.
Some of your favorites.
Why don't we start... Why don't we start with all right, this fact, first of all. I was talking with a friend about witches the other day, and I actually grew up on the North Shore of Massachusetts, where there was heavy-duty witch hunting in several centuries, 17th, 18th. And our big outing when we were teenagers was to go to the Salem Witch House and let the guides take us through it. And there were three sisters there who were killed as witches, who were basically mystics. They had mystical visions, and they were trying to heal people. They were trying to help people. And that seems to be a pretty typical experience of the witch. You know, she's supposed to be...
a healer.
She's supposed to, but society says she's a demoniacal entity, and
in fact
she is an absolutely, you know, she's a saint.
Yes.
And I was thinking of, in this book, if you go through the book, you'll find that a number of women over the past 3,000 years have been killed because of what they believed, of saying what they believed and practicing what they believed. And today, I saw a shift. It's very, very interesting. We get into the 20th century. All of a sudden, instead of killing us, they're listening to us. And I think that's really fascinating. And I thought if we looked at one of the older stories that had a bad ending, and then compare it with one in the 20th century where she got listened to instead of killed.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that might be fun.
Isn't that, that'd be really fun. Isn't that interesting, though? I mean, that is where we are coming from, and that's why it's so important to understand the history of women, is that when women stood in their power and had their voice, oftentimes they were killed. And in times of the witches, I saw a great documentary on witches once, and it was talking about how witches were the original people that were considered the healers if the doctors didn't work, or people would go if they didn't have enough money to go to a hospital. And these women, it was always women, would have their potions and remedies, often teas or herbs or whatever we use today. And people would get well. And that was happening so often that these, it was considered black magic, and that it was not anything that the establishment understood. So they started killing and starting a movement, essentially saying that these are wrong. And most of these women were having to hide and were having to stay protected and live in dungeons so that they wouldn't be killed. Yet they were still being brought the sick and the wounded and still healing and curing these people, and yet were in fear of their lives. And
well, we have a lot of that in our past. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's very interesting that you spoke about the establishment there that was doing the killing, you know. And I have discovered women in indigenous tribes where they become heroines. If they have the powers to heal, or there's in Mexico, there's a woman called Rosario Castellanos, and the great, great tragedy there is to be infertile and not be able to produce a child. And those women traditionally have become the healers, the curanderas.
Wow.
And so it's an honor, it's a blessing in the tribe that you have an infertile woman who can play that role.
Wow, and now that's not in our country, though.
No. I mean, this would be in the poor countries like Mexico and in Africa, and,
mm-hmm.
Australia, Aboriginal.
Interesting. Now that's really interesting to know. So the consciousness that we were raised with was a little bit different, and something that we have had to move out of through the ages.
Right.
So these women, the wisdom that you have in this book is from all over the world.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You see, we're all alike all over the world. We have the same inner courage, and we can stand up to the obstacles and overcome.
So you brought up the witches.
Okay,
are you going to share?
Let's go to that. The one I'll read to you about, it's very short, it's about Marguerite Perret, and this is back in the year 1310. And
wow.
She was told to stop talk. She was silenced, like they silenced Matthew Fox a few years ago,
uh-huh.
and she refused. And so here's a little passage. This is the book that threatened them. I've called the section The Empty Mirror. And she says, "You who will read this book, if you want to understand it deeply, think about it before you speak about it, for it is difficult to understand. You must be your real self, neither more nor less, unconcerned with appearances. If you want to treasure spiritual knowledge, you must have the modesty of a mother." I love that. And then she goes, "Theologians and other clerics, you will not understand it at all. So learned are your minds, unless you proceed humbly, with love and trust, the only forces in your soul that can lead you where reason cannot go. Reason itself will show you later in this book that love and trust give reason life, and that she cannot live free of them, for they empower the soul far more than reason ever could. Reason must be humbled, and humbled all sciences which are founded on reason alone, but place all your trust in science illumined by faith and love. And then you will understand my book, written in the love that gives life to the soul." How ambitious was the soul who wrote this book, for it isn't possible to put into words a thing so precious, so beautiful, that it can't even be thought, nor spoken, nor done. It is as if I'd wanted to pour the whole sea into an eye, or carry the world on the point of a reed, or use a candle to illumine the sun. It is impossible. And guess what? They burned her at the stake.
Wow. For that writing?
Yep.
That's what I thought you said beforehand, and I thought, well, maybe I misunderstood her. That was beautiful.
It's incredible. She was a beginner. Oh, it's just...
Wow.
That story just absolutely kills me, and there's so many...
It's truth. It's about truth.
So, yeah, and we just think, well, Joan of Arc was killed. We have no idea of all these other women.
Mm-hmm. I was going to mention Joan of Arc.
So I didn't. I left Joan of Arc out because everybody knew about her.
That's okay. She's had her time. I mean, her glory definitely is appreciated. And there's other women that need to be appreciated as well.
Right. So now if we skip up to our time, and this is Chan Kong, and you know who Thich Nhat Hanh is?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is the woman who always appears with Thich Nhat Hanh, and nobody realizes how important she is. But she's like his number two person, and she's a brilliant leader and a great, great monk. She fought to liberate people in the Vietnam War, which, of course, she calls the American War.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
she relates a story that happened just before the Tet Offensive. And she was at that time a university professor. She hadn't become a nun. And a bulletin came out one afternoon that a number of people would have to report to the ministry in exactly 1.5 hour. And her name was on this list. And the radios kept blaring this every 10 minutes for these people to report to the ministry. Now, it seemed they were going to be blamed for the Tet Offensive and were going to be killed. So her family begged her not to go. And she says, I was very afraid. But I thought the whole thing had been my idea, I had to take full responsibility and go. So what she was going to have to do was retract her peace work or they were going to kill her. But she tried something. She went to wisdom, which is what we're talking about. She went very deep. And then she got to the minister and she said, I breathed deeply and said in a firm voice, Sir, I come to you today because I knew that you were once a professor, my elder brother in teaching. When you speak in such a threatening way, it is impossible for us to have real communication. Sir, I am like a bamboo shoot among university teachers. I am young, but my spirit may grow strong and beautiful. I spoke out frankly about the situation in this country, not for my own sake, but for the sake of the nation, even though prison or death may await me as a result. I appeal to your conscience as an elder brother to help me grow in this attitude, not to bow before coercion. Don't force me to go against my conscience. If I agree to sign your petition under threat of violence, then tonight, if unknown men enter my house with guns and force me to sign a petition saying, Long live Mao Zedong, must I not also sign that? If I sign under the threat of guns against my conscience and my belief, who will be at fault? Do you really want to teach me that way of coercion?
And that was her way of trying to stand up for herself.
She said he looked embarrassed and he let me go.
Wow. And that worked. So I see how you're comparing the 1300s now to the 1900s, early 19th century.
So we've made a little progress.
Yes. But the good news is the early 19th century was when women's voices were starting to be accepted a little bit more in powerful positions, and then not. But that's a great choice to put in the book because it's inspiring. And it worked.
I'm so glad you feel that.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. There's also, other than the women issue, you have some readings in here that address just the simple things such as loneliness, which is what I got out of the one by Mary Oliver.
Oh, that's such a beautiful poem.
This is a really beautiful poem.
Oh, I love her.
And that's kind of what I got this applies to everybody. You actually had another quote by Mary Oliver in the beginning of the of your book, and I liked it. It said,
would you be willing to read it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The quote that I liked at the beginning of the book, it says, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?
Oh, yeah, isn't that great?
That's a great phrase. It's a terrific phrase. This one I'll read. It's called Wild Geese, and I extrapolated a theme of it addresses loneliness, and it has an answer to it. And I kind of got that out of it, but listen with your ears and you can hear. It's a short one. It says, "You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees and the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese high in the clean blue air are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things."
So beautiful.
I think that is really wonderful. Isn't that wonderful?
Yes.
It just says, you know, life goes on. Geese are going to fly, and the water's still going to run, and you may have your drama and your trauma, and it's still going to be all right. Is that
what
it says?
True.
Maybe that's just me in my life right now. Is that what it says? It may mean something totally different, like animal preservation or something. Did I miss it?
Well, that goes to that beautiful line, you only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. I love that.
I know. That is beautiful. Very beautiful. Yeah. So it does speak to that. No matter where you are in your life, the world offers itself to your imagination.
Right.
Very, very well put.
You know, I found a lot in relationship to loneliness is the let me back up for a second. I found that the themes that seem to be the most painful are made meaningful when they're in the sacred context, which I'm sure everybody on your show talks about. And loneliness was one of them. And the other one I noticed over and over again was aging. And I thought this was particularly fascinating that two weeks ago, I heard Judi Dench interviewed on 60 Minutes, I think. Did you hear it by any chance?
No, but I love her.
I love her too. She was Queen Elizabeth and Shakespeare in Love, and she's absolutely glorious. But she shocked me with something, Lisa. She said they asked her how she felt about aging. And they said, "Now you're 67. You know, how do you feel about aging?" And I was expecting her to say, "Oh, life just gets better every moment." She said, "It's hell. I hate it."
And wow.
You know, that really shocked me because I said, no spiritual attitude to aging. Because when you see the women in this book write about aging, it's a holy thing. And it's moving towards the wholeness of a life. And there's an article in here called The Delight of Old Age. And she makes the point that she took up yoga in her 50s. And now in her 70s, she feels better than she's ever felt in her life and is loving life more than ever.
You know, there was a woman who spoke, and I don't remember the story where it came from, but a Native American elder, there were a number of them interviewed, and they were all between 100 years old and 107 years old.
My.
And they were about 20 of them interviewed, and they were asked, "What was your favorite age to go back to?"
Uh-huh.
And you know what they said? 70.
They said the 70s?
70s. Yes, and I didn't read on to figure out why, because it was just the intro part of it. And then I came to my own conclusion, and I thought, you know, really at 70, your life in terms of the work and the struggle and all of that is really done at that point. And if you're healthy, at that point you can really enjoy nature, life's little messages. You have a different perspective on things. You have time to smell the roses. And I thought, wow, that's really interesting. Now, of course, these people had another 30 years on top of that. But I thought that was just so interesting.
It's amazing. And then people,
it says a lot about aging.
And people have more time so that they can do all these athletic things. But the other thing is that they become more contemplative.
Yes.
I mean, they just deepen. If this may be the first time in life to deepen and to get closer to the divine presence. And you know, maybe unconsciously preparing for the end of life.
Yeah, and accepting that. And the beautiful thing is that all these meditations and a lot of books are written about finding that contemplative peace, yet it's it's right there when you're 70, and it's what we're trying to achieve, and it's really interesting. So I just thought that was an interesting perspective. But we are going to take a quick break, and
okay.
I'm going to come back with our wonderful conversation here with Mary Ford Grabowski. She's the author of Sacred Voices, and we're going to come back and hear about more women's wisdom through the ages, more stories, more poems, more quotes. So we will be right back. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Aware on KPFK. Welcome back to Aware. Hi, this is Lisa Garr, and my guest today is Mary Ford Grabowski. Among many books, Mary has written Sacred Voices. It's essential women's wisdom through the ages. She has been sharing with us some of the writings all through time. I guess the earliest is around the 13th century is what you were talking about. Is that right, Mary?
I've gone back to 2300 BCE.
Oh, you are amazing.
It covers 4,300 years.
Wow.
Oh. Yeah, I really worked hard on this
you
one.
Dug, didn't
I,
you?
I just canvassed the libraries in all my spare time, called myself an archaeologist of the sacred feminine.
You sure are. You are quite a scholar. 170 women with writings, compiling splendid writings of women mystics and spiritual leaders from diverse cultures and traditions, poets. And this is really a wonderful one of the ones that I recognize the name of. Was Starhawk.
Uh-huh.
And she's a pretty popular one. I think we know from her, we've interviewed a couple of Brooke Medicine Eagle and a couple of Native American women on the show, and they've often referred to her readings. Do you want to share that one?
Sure. Let me just...
Okay. Did I spring that one out of you? Sorry.
That's fine. Power over and power from within.
Yes.
I write about the calling forth of power, a power based on principles very different from power over, from domination. For power over is ultimately the power of the gun and the bomb, the power of annihilation that backs up all the institutions of domination. So good since 9/11.
Very true.
There are many names for power from within, none of them entirely satisfactory. It can be called spirit, but that name implies that it is separate from matter, and that false spirit is the foundation of the institution of domination. It could be called God. The God of patriarchal religions has been the ultimate source of power over. I've called it immanence, a term that is truthful but somewhat cold and intellectual. And I've called it goddess because the ancient images, symbols, and myths of the goddess as birth giver, weaver, earth and growing plant, wind and ocean, flame, web, moon, and milk all speak to me of the powers of connectedness, sustenance, healing, creating. The word goddess makes many people who would define themselves as political uneasy. It implies religion, secularism, and can be mistaken for the worship of an external being. Goddess also makes people who would define themselves as spiritual or religious uneasy. It smacks of paganism, of blood, darkness, of sexuality, of lower powers. Yet power from within is the power of the low, the dark, the earth, the power that rises from our own blood and our lives and our passionate desire for each other's living flesh. And the political issues of our time are also issues of spirit, conflicts between paradigms or underlying principles. If we are to survive, the question becomes, how do we overthrow not those presently in power, but the principle of power over? How do we shape a society based on the principle of power from within?
Very interesting. I would even say it's power over power. Versus power from within. And how can we, especially looking in light of the incidents of 9/11, how can we stop this power struggle, power over power struggle, and rule our, or not even rule, but exist in power from within?
I know the answer to the question.
Please.
I think the answer to the question is to get the sacred feminine, which is just beginning to be born,
mm-hmm.
out into society.
What is that, the sacred feminine, to you? What does that mean?
It's the heart of our souls. You see, that's the question. What is our soul like? It's the all the qualities in all our voices. It's feminine wisdom. It's our love for the earth. It's our passion, our sexual passion and sensuality. It's our love of connecting and our spontaneity and flexibility. It's also our sharp emotions, our anger and our rage. But it's everything that that distinguishes us from the lonely, upward striving, sacred masculine, which is not as concerned with community as we are, which is not concerned with feelings as we are. It's our complement. But right now it rules the world, and it drives so hard from the testosterone and from the nature of the masculine, the healthy masculine. It's very, very aggressive. But it needs to be partnered with our own type of aggression, which has more to do with love and wisdom than with killing another person.
Yes, and that's why there's going to be a next female president of the United States. No, I mean, that would be the answer. That would be the maturing, caring, intuitive Earth Mother in our, office. It would be a very wonderful answer. And do you see that happening any time in the next 20 years?
No. But, you have to think that we are, as we women, basically had our bodies severed from our heads about 2,500 years ago when they destroyed all the statues of the Great Mother and forbade women to worship the Great Mother. Women would take these little statues to bed with them when they were having a baby, or they'd put the little statue of the Mother Goddess by their child when she was sick, and they always had little altars in their rooms. This is back now 1,500 years before Christ, and all up until 400, but 400 years before Christ seems to be the time when they shattered the last Great Mother and threw her out of the temple and imposed worship of the Father. And ever since then, we have been hideously wounded, wounded emotionally, spiritually, physically. You know, our sixth chakra has been shut down because we couldn't speak out our voice. And we are the first generation, after all these thousands of years, we're the first generation to try to turn it around. And we are turning it around.
I was going to say it is happening, and although I think it's important to have this type of knowledge and to really understand that there was suffering and there was a complete denial of the feminine and a submissive actions being put towards women. It has definitely changed now. It has definitely changed. And it's a bit confusing because we now have power and we don't know sometimes what to do with it. And then we do know what to do with it. It's a balance. But I think it has changed. Do you?
Oh, I definitely think it is changing. We have power among ourselves. First of all, we can talk on the internet and women are listening to women.
Mm-hmm.
That Chen Kong story shows how she was listened to by the hierarchy. And little by little, I think we are being more and more heard. Writing is a major way.
Through books.
For women, As the women are out traveling and speaking and teaching and not in the boardroom, but then who get there seem to die pretty quickly of the same heart attacks and strokes that kill men.
Yes, isn't that interesting?
Can I read you an incredible? This is my favorite section from the whole book, which I think says so much about a woman's soul because only a woman could have created this.
Mm-hmm. Yes, please.
This is from Louise Ettrich. I think it's the most sacred writing.
Is this the one about the animals?
It's the last buffalo hunt.
Oh yes, this was hard for me to read.
If you know about the buffalo hunts, you perhaps know that the one I described, now many generations past, was one of the last. Directly after that hunt, in fact, before which Father Lacombe made a great act of contrition, and the whirlwind destruction, lasting only 20 minutes, left 1,200 animals dead. The rest of the herd did not bolt away, but behaved in a chilling way. As many witnesses told it, the surviving buffalo milled at the outskirts of the carnage, not grazing, but watching with an insane intensity as one by one, swiftly and painstakingly, each carcass was dismantled. Even through the night, the buffalo stayed and were seen by the uneasy hunters and their families the next dawn to have remained standing quietly as though mourning their young and their dead. All their relatives that lay before them, more or less unjointed, detongued, legless, headless, skinned. At noon, the flies descended. The buzzing was horrendous. The sky went black. It was then at the sun's zenith, the light shredded by scarves of moving black insects. The buffalo began to make a sound. It was a sound never heard before. No buffalo had ever made this sound. No one knew what the sound meant, except that one old toughened hunter sucked his breath in when he heard it. And as the sound increased, he attempted not to cry out. Tears ran over his cheeks and down his throat anyway, wetting his shoulders, as the sound gathered power until everyone was lost in the immensity. That sound was heard once and never to be heard again. That sound made the body ache, the mind pinch shut. An unmistakable and violent grief. It was as though the earth was sobbing.
And now you know why that was the last buffalo hunt.
Right.
Oh, that was so moving.
And look at how she brings in animal spirits, human spirits, the man who's trying so hard not to cry, and the great spirit, which is just full of the divine presence.
Mm-hmm. And it was, as anybody like I am is so impassioned about animals, the visuals.
Are you?
Oh, yes, the visuals came up, and it just hurt to read that.
It's hard to talk after that. You know, I feel like we should play music or something.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a very good point. We should have. There's a number of just heart-stopping poems in here that are educational. I mean, this is really, really good information. That's something that Howard Lyman could use and that John Robbins could use and their Earth Save International. Hmm. And those are really beautiful pieces of literature and messages. Here's the other one is on a little lighter note. The Zen Art of Cooking.
Okay. Would you like to read that? Are you a cook?
I'm not. But...
I'm not either.
Oh, really? So for those that are, it's really kind of fun because it talks about making tofu and what it involves and exactly what cooking does for you. If you're a cook, if you're a chef, I know many of them, and this is what happens. As the process of preparing food takes over, there is mu, another called nothingness. The mind enters a state in which it is not caught up in anything. So if you're thinking, let's prepare this well for others, or let's offer our affectionate heart in preparing this food, you will not know your practice, and it is still shallow. When you are doing your best, you get to the point where you are just doing your best, not thinking about it. So let us use as an example the dish called sesame tofu. It is a difficult dish made from ground sesame, water, and arrowroot, and it must be stirred for a very long time, and it is hard work. When you are stirring and stirring with all your might, enough of the heavy batter for 50 people, it is so hard that you want to give up being a human being. But in the midst of the stirring, you are not thinking of anything. All your attention is on the sesame. You just keep stirring and watching until the heat begins to soften the mixture and it becomes elastic. You just keep looking into the pan and stirring until the sesame tofu tells you what to do. It gets heavy again and then soft again until suddenly the surface swells up and leaps forward, making a clear sound. It tells you that it's ready. Then as you quickly respond and move it from the heat, a wonderful, delicious aroma comes floating up, and you know with your whole body that the sesame tofu is done. If your attention wanders even a little, if your mind jumps to something else for even a moment, the sesame will burn. So you put everything you've got into it. You are completely one-pointed on what you are doing. That is the Zen art of cooking, and that is a lot of fun.
That's great, isn't it?
Oh, it's fun. It explains anything else that you're doing in your life with passion.
That, exactly. And that's, you know, that's the issue of work.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
Can we work with that? I can't say in most of my career as an academic that I had that attitude. You know, just...
Right.
We just go charging through, you know, mm-hmm. and work so hard and so fast. This is this is just a wonderful approach if we could do it.
Yeah, if we can do it. It is. It just kind of explains your, I'm sure, I mean, that would describe anybody who, even if you're not a cook, when you got involved with something that you really just get immersed in, time disappears and you let the thing that you're doing tell you what to do.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there's another group of writings in here which I just adored because I don't sew either.
Okay.
Do you?
No, I don't.
Okay. Oh, but these are wonderful. And I would have to, after reading these writings, I'd have to call it sacred sewing because I can mention someone from today. Let me mention an old, or someone from the past first. She was a mystic, and she sewed on her dress the verses of a prayer that she'd written, which was extremely, extremely beautiful.
Wow.
And she then she would, was kind of like my post-its in the closet. She would see that every time she put that robe on and remember to meditate on her favorite verses.
Hmm.
And I thought that was, you know, it was quaint. It was kind of strange. And I was telling that to a friend of mine, Mary, who owns Sagrada, a sacred arts and books over in Oakland, and she said, oh my goodness, she said, I did the exact same thing. She said, when I was about 17, she said, one summer I had a white dress, and I sewed embroidered all my favorite lines from the Bible on the top of this dress.
Wow.
And I thought, how did this happen 2,000 years apart?
Interesting.
And then I was at the university when I was working with Matt Fox at the university, and I had to, I love Clarissa Pinkola says, and I was meeting her when she was getting off the elevator, and
wow,
out walks Clarissa in a long red dress with sewn on the front of the dress this multicolored image about 14 inches tall of Our Lady of Guadalupe.
Oh, wow.
It was spectacular. It was sensationally, you know, compelling and beautiful.
So it was a theme that had been carried. It was a great idea.
Yeah, so, you know, apparently throughout history, women have been doing these things, even to today.
Yes, it's true. I mean, it's kind of the perfect thing to do. I mean, it makes a lot of sense. So, or you could call it collective consciousness. You can call it whatever you want, but it makes a lot of sense. It's a great idea.
But I always demeaned anything that had to do with sewing.
Well, I know. I don't cook. I don't sew. I don't know. What am I? I'm not a woman, right? No, absolutely not. You know, there's a couple other ones in here I wanted you to read, if you could, about the about dance. Which one was it? It was the one by Marion, page 214.
Oh, Marion Woodman?
Yes.
On the dance?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just... It was probably not, it's a little long to read over the air, but it was a kind of combination of a story written about a woman who was performing a dance, and her final performance was completely fluid and flawless, where she changed into this kind of, it was kind of a mystical experience to all those watching, and it was that moment where you see an incredible transformation happen to somebody who's on stage in front of you, and you feel it in the audience, and it's a really beautiful, rare experience. And this poem was written about from the person in the audience. Is that right?
Yes, and that's Marion Woodman, who's a very famous Jungian analyst.
Mm. Hmm.
She does. Do you want to read it or not? Because it's a little long.
It is a little long, but what is it that the story tells?
Well, it talked about the her dancing with finishing her career. This is also about aging, and she was in her late 40s, and she gave up her ballet career. This is just a few years ago, and she this Marion Woodman was at her last performance, and she said she was technically perfect. The ballerina was technically perfect, but she was like a cold, hard diamond. There was no sign of real love, of spirit, of soul in her at all. It made me think of a machine, you know, that would just perform perfunctorily. And then they paired her with Rudolf Nureyev, the great, great, great ballet dancer. And it said suddenly she just blossomed and just her whole soul exploded and she became like a radiant pearl.
Mm.
Also, they said part animal and part divine. It just... He constellated the soul in her, and she did in him. I mean, I suppose in a way they fell in love.
And that was her ending of the experience as her in her performing.
She came back. She came back and she started her whole career all over again.
Oh, you're
at
kidding.
50.
Wow.
And I think she danced with him for 10 years more.
Oh, my goodness.
It's amazing what women can do.
Well, it's also a great example of when you rekindle the passion in your work or in whatever it is you're doing, that it becomes new again.
Do we have about 3 minutes for me to tell you a story of an amazing woman in this book?
Yes.
The introductions are the life stories, and that's about half the book, and then the little excerpts are the other half of the book. But I put made the life stories long because the women in our past are so great. And I want to mention Perpetua. She was back 20 year old around the year 200. And she reminds me of, have you heard how Luther nailed his theses on the Wittenberg Castle, and he took this fateful stand that nearly cost him his life, and he said these famous lines, "Here I stand, I cannot do otherwise, so help me God, amen."
Mm-hmm.
And that's inspired people, you know, in history for 400 years.
Yes.
But nobody has ever heard of a woman who did something very similar back 1,300 years before Luther in the year 200. And I think these are the kinds of stories we should be telling our daughter. She took a similarly, her name is Perpetua. Perpetua took a similarly courageous stand, knowing it could lead to her death. And she spoke the words very, very dramatically when the Roman Empire was accusing her of refusing to sacrifice to the gods, and she wouldn't, because of her religious beliefs, she would not do it. But it was a duty, an annual duty in Rome, to sacrifice to the gods. And so her family was imploring her to do it. Everyone was imploring her. She was just married. She had a new baby that she was nursing. And Perpetua somehow found the composure to stand up and say, "I cannot be other than what I am."
Mm.
And, I think of that, Lisa, as the teaching for young women today, just to hold firm, remain true to yourself. You have the courage. Here, we older people have a vision of faith that we can give you. So she makes her decision at that moment, and then she has a series of numinous dreams that are absolutely beautiful, and you watch her mature, and she matures at lightning speed until she's got the wisdom of one of those 70-year-olds you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a scene, the narrator tells a scene in the arena. She's going to be thrown, she's going to die at the hands of wild animals in the arena. And so he notes this detail that is one of the most tender things I've ever read in literature. It's so real. She's charged by an animal, and she's knocked down for the first time. She doesn't scream. She doesn't lose her poise. She's in pain, obviously. She sits up. She brushes off her skirt. She picks up a hairpin that's fallen on the ground, and she neatly replaces that in her hair. And then, as though she'd recovered her dignity, her spirit is centered again, she's ready, and she's ready to stand up and face what's ahead. And unfortunately, she lost her life.
Right. It was a tragedy. And then the whole thing, the way that she did it, was a triumph.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's, in our history, we have so many women conscientious objectors that we know nothing about. There are a dozen examples in this book.
Right. No, that's a really good one, and I love that phrase, "I cannot be other than who I am." And that's very, very, very powerful. And to anybody of all ages, to really stand up for who you are and what you believe in and what your style or what your flair or what your beliefs are and everything that you are, and stand there in that, and don't be afraid of criticism or judgment. And the longer you do that, the more it becomes a part of you. And you accept it inside of yourself. It's beautiful.
And that's part of your answer to how we could change this world. I mean,
that's
if
true.
If our sex does this, you know, and if we teach our daughters to do this, that will do something.
Absolutely. Well, you've been just a joy to speak to, and what a wonderful conversation. I really appreciate all that you've gathered together. Your body of work is immense, and this is just one of your books.
Thank you. I've loved talking to you.
It's been great. Now, Where can people reach you? I have this here. If they wanted to, well, the book is called Sacred Voices, and your email is maryfordg@aol.com.
Like my name, maryfordg@aol.com. They can use that. Or they can use my box number.
Let's see here.
And you got it there?
Yep, I do. But also, there you got a another book coming out. Well, actually, it's a book that you, is this your newest book, Matthew Fox at 60?
That one already came out. The new book that I'm working on now is also for Harper San Francisco, and it's it can be all women's sacred poems and prayers.
That's great. Well, this is Essential Women's Wisdom Through the Ages. Again, the name of the book is called Sacred Voices, and Mary Ford Grabowski has been my guest, and I want to thank you again for joining me this afternoon. A wonderful conversation.
My pleasure, Lisa. Thank you so much.
All right. Take good care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Mary Ford Grabowski. Sacred Voices is the name of the book, Essential Women's Wisdom Through the Ages, more than 170 writings from women mystics and spiritual leaders from diverse cultures and traditions, a really wonderful book, and a joy to read. That is it for me this afternoon, and while I am committed to bringing you the clearest information possible in the end, I always encourage you to listen to your own truth. Until tomorrow, I invite you to stay aware.